his take on the people she knew in his department. Then there was that moment when he stopped talking in mid-sentence to say, "You're really something special, Yuki." She had told him about her Italian-American father and Japanese mom, whose voice she could sometimes still hear. He hadn't laughed at that. The conversation rolled on and the chemistry between them was immediate. Now, as they followed the hostess past the cascading copper waterfall through the near-empty restaurant, Yuki hoped that something good would come from hijacking her husband, hoped that they would feel that connection that had bonded them the night they met. Chapter 30. When Yuki and Brady were seated in their booth, their drink orders in, Yuki put her hand on her husband's arm.
"Brady,"
she said,
"full disclosure, my birthday is next week. I called an emergency dinner."
"You're kidding me. What, hon? What's wrong?"
She looked down at the table, her rehearsed speech feeling thick and stupid and stuck in her throat. She remembered what Claire had said.
"That man loves you to death."
Maybe Brady didn't realize the width of the gap that was opening between them. She felt the weight of the angel skin coral beads around her neck. Brady's wedding gift to her before their honeymoon cruise. People had died on that ship. Brady had saved lives. He'd saved her life. She'd loved him then, and had come to love him even more. What was he feeling?
"Yuki, what is it?"
"I miss you, Brady. We never talk anymore,"
she said.
"We need to talk."
Brady smiled, grabbed her hand, and said,
"Aw, thanks for the sneaky heads up on your birthday. I'll be sure to send flowers next week."
Yuki thought,
"He doesn't get it. Or he doesn't feel the same way. Or he doesn't want to open up."
All of that was possible. All of that was painful. Their waitress materialized with a blood-orange margarita for her, sparkling water with a slice of lemon for Brady. Yuki put down half her drink right away. She had told Claire that neither she nor Brady liked to talk about squishy feelings, but hell, an uncomfortable talk was not just necessary, it was overdue. Bolstered by tequila, Yuki took the plunge, again.
"It feels like we're losing each other,"
she said.
"I'm right here," said Brady. "Scooch over."
She slid toward him, and Brady reached over and dragged her close, wrapping both of his arms around her, resting his chin on the top of her head and saying,
"What brought this on? Oh, I get it."
He pulled back to look into her face.
"This is about your birthday. And now you're thinking about having a baby?"
Yuki leaned against Brady's chest, slipped her fingers between his shirt buttons.
"No,"
she said.
"No, this isn't about a baby. Not now."
"Okay, good. What is it then?"
her husband asked.
"Don't you feel it?"
she said.
"That we're kind of drifting apart?"
There was some silence before Brady said,
"I see. I see. I'm neglecting you."
He disengaged from their embrace, seemed flustered or as if he was looking for the right words. He sipped his water before saying,
"Jacoby unloaded a pile of administrative work on me. He just can't handle it all anymore. On top of that, and every other dog biting my butt, I'm primary on that attempted murder and suicide."
Yuki had heard about the case. A woman had left divorce court and driven her car onto a sidewalk and into her husband, his girlfriend, and the husband's lawyer. Then she had sped to the Golden Gate Bridge, climbed over the railing, and jumped to her death. Brady said,
"The husband and girlfriend are okay, but the lawyer is in ICU. If he dies, it's gotta be processed as a homicide, even though the killer already self-inflicted the death penalty."
Yuki said,
"See, I miss talking like this. Even about work. Hearing what you're thinking about."
He tipped up her chin and pecked her lips. When dinner came, Yuki turned down another drink. Brady ate like he hadn't eaten in the last 24 hours. After he had put down his knife and fork, he asked her to bring him up to speed on her woman-on-man rape case. While she was telling him, he glanced at his phone a couple or three times, saying,
"Hang on," and "Excuse me,"
returning texts before shutting the phone off.
"Sorry,"
he said.
"Work. My phone is always open."
He couldn't turn off his phone for an hour? That clinging sadness she'd been carrying around had finally lightened, and now it was weighing her down again. They skipped dessert and coffee. Later that night, when they were both in bed and rain clouds veiled, then revealed the full moon outside their bedroom window, Yuki lay wide awake. Had Brady been telling her the truth when he said he was just overly busy? Or was he keeping something from her? What in the world was wrong? Chapter 31. Yuki dropped off to sleep sometime after 2 and slept through the alarm that went off at 7:30. Later, when she started awake, Brady's side of the bed was empty. She would just get to work on time if she pulled herself together fast, and somehow she did it, walking smartly through the doorway to the DA's suite of offices at 9:15. Apart from the fact that her hair was still damp, she was good to go. The DA's office was organized with small windowed rooms at the perimeter, surrounding a maze of cubicles at the center. The cubes were fully occupied with paralegals and assistants on the phones, making casework hum. As Yuki passed Len's corner office, his assistant, Tony Reynolds, who manned the desk outside his door, waved her down.
"Yuki, Len needs to see you and Arthur. Right away."
"Now?"
"As soon as his meeting breaks up," Tony said. "Oh, good, here's Arthur. Both of you please sit down. He'll be right with you."
Yuki was surprised at this summons to Len's office. Right away? What had happened? Yuki and Arthur had hardly settled into chairs in the hallway when Len Parisi's office door blew open. Len's assistant said to Yuki,
"I hope you don't mind, but I had to coordinate a lot of schedules. Judge Rathburn wants to see all concerned at 10.
Yuki didn't know why the judge wanted to see them, and she didn't get a chance to ask. Parisi appeared in his doorway looking exasperated and told Yuki and Art to come in. They took the love seat and watched the big man edge behind his cluttered mahogany desk and sink heavily into his chair. He moved stacks of papers around on his desk, lined up his pens, then got into the business at hand.
"Giftos filed a motion to suppress the sex video,"
he said.
"That video is all we've got. I've never felt at peace with that. Rathburn is reasonable," he said. "He listens and he can be reached. Don't let Giftos intimidate you, Yuki, and he will try."
Yuki said,
"People underestimating me is my secret weapon."
Parisi cracked a smile, then said,
"Tony set the meeting for 10. It's 9:30. Don't be late."
She and Arthur sprang from the sofa and out the door. At the elevator bank, Yuki watched the indicator lights track the car down from the jail on the 7th floor. The elevator was old, creaky, slow. Like everything in the Hall of Justice, outmoded.
"Stairs," Art said.
"Done."
They took the fire exit, and as they jogged down to the 2nd floor, Arthur said,
"I had a dream. We were in court, and a pack of dogs came rushing through the door. They were on the scent of something big, and they were determined."
"How'd you know that?"
"I don't know. I woke up."
Yuki laughed.
"That's it? The whole dream?"
"The lead dog had red fur."
She smiled at her new deputy.
"Well, Arthur, we're about to face off against the man who set Len's hair on fire."
As they walked along the hallway, Yuki turned her mind back to this complication that could kneecap the case against Brianna Hill. Without the video, it was Mark Christopher's word against Brianna Hill's, a coin toss that left plenty of room for a jury to find reasonable doubt. Yuki didn't know Judge Rathburn, but she knew James Giftos. He was the type of defense lawyer who was sometimes called a bomb. Would Rathburn allow the video into evidence? Or would James Giftos, a man 20 years older than she, with twice as much trial experience, blow up her case before she ever presented it to the jury? Chapter 32. My head was still swimming with images from the Pier 45 murder scene when I arrived at my desk the morning after. I envisioned the sparse crowd on the pier. The deceased, Laura Russell, in her blood. Her crying teenage daughter. I thought about the sketchy second-hand report that the shooter was white and had worn a nice coat. And of course, I was still stuck on the rude dismissal by Sergeant Garth Stevens. Conklin hadn't yet punched in, so I headed for the break room and found that Sergeant Paul Chi and his partner, Cappy McNeil, had appropriated the table. I've worked with these two homicide pros since back in the far distant day when Jacoby and I were partners. Chi is precise, diligent, a man Jacoby refers to as human ground-penetrating radar. I remember Jacoby toasting Chi when he was promoted to sergeant, saying, "Chi can see around corners and beyond time." Cappy is a different kind of cop, a career detective who, in 20 years on the force, has solved case after case without ever getting ruffled or into a jam. I thought Chi and McNeil could give me some advice about the murder of Laura Russell. They made room for me at the table, and we sat together with a box of pastries between us. When I had laid it all out, including the intel from my confidential informant and my personal experience with Stevens and Moran, I asked, "Do either of you know these guys?"
"I know Stevens," Cappy said, tucking into a honey bun. "What do you want to know?"
"What you got?" He chewed slowly, swallowed, and finally said,
"This is just between you, me, Chi, and Honeybun, and I'm about to take Ms. Bun down."
"Agreed," I said. Between bites, the wise Cappy McNeil told me that Stevens was a dedicated drinker. No surprise, since he and my father had been fellow barflies. Cappy added that Moran had been violent with two different girlfriends, or so he'd been told. He didn't introduce his gun into the fights, but he knocked those women around pretty bad. If he was a pro ball player, he'd have been suspended for at least a year. I pushed for more. "Any known misbehavior on the job?"
Chi said, "This is all gossip. You understand, Boxer."
"I understand. What's the gossip?"
"When Stevens was in narcotics, there was talk that he may have gotten payoffs from a big-time dealer. Well, I only heard about it after some evidence against that guy went missing."
"Come on. He's that dirty?"
"The talk never became an investigation," said Cappy. "Stevens's boss, Lieutenant Chris Levant, liked him then and likes him to this day. Their wives are friends. So Stevens was moved to Central Station's investigative team and later partnered up with Moran. The two then became the hub of Levant's homicide detail."
Cappy continued,
"They did close out that case of a teenage girl who went missing in Polk Gulch. Found her body in a storage locker, and they collared the perp who was then convicted. So whatever else, they do a good job."
I told Chi and McNeil what my CI had said, that a string of homeless people had been shot with no arrests. She said about three, and that was before the last two.
"You sure about that? You checked out the database?" Chi asked me.
"I did, but I don't have names. I'm not even sure if the victims had IDs. If the cases weren't worked up, they could have easily been filed as identity unknown, case to be solved after the second coming." The bullpen was starting to get noisy. The night shift was checking out and the day shift was drifting into the break room, calling back and forth, laughing, filling up their mugs and grabbing sugared breakfast treats. Chi hunched over the table and said,
"Say there's something to this, Boxer. What would be the point of Stevens lying down on the job?"
I shrugged. "I hoped you'd tell me."
"Careful," said Cappy. "Like I said, Levant is Stevens's godfather. He has weight with the mayor."
I mimed zipping my lip. Chi grabbed hold of my arm.
"Trust your gut."
"Okay. Thank you." I was rinsing out my mug when Conklin came through the doorway. He pulled a cup off the drain board and joked around with Chi and Cappy about not getting any sleep last night.
"Your girlfriend pretty glad to see you, Sonny?" said Cappy.
I rolled my eyes and left them to the boy talk. At my desk, I booted up my computer and started going through my email. I was thinking of telling Brady that I was disturbed about how poorly the murder scene had been handled. But I vividly remembered that he'd told me to step back. He was the boss, and he wasn't subtle. I knew I should listen to him. All I had to go on was Millie Cushing's bug in my ear, and a strong feeling that Stevens and Moran, key players in Lieutenant Levant's obsolete homicide fiefdom, weren't right. Hunches are valuable in this line of work. As Paul Chi had said, I had to trust my gut. Chapter 33. Judge Rathburn was on the phone when Yuki and Art arrived, but waved them into his chambers and offered them chairs in the seating area at the far end of the room. The judge was in his 50s, bearded and wearing glasses, suit pants, a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up, and a gold and green striped tie. His office walls were hung with family photos and framed quotes from famous people ranging from Ronald Reagan and John Wayne to Theodore Roosevelt and Mother Teresa. A sculpture of the scales of justice took up a corner of his desk, and he had a pretty good view of the traffic on Bryant Street under an overcast sky. Rathburn was saying,
"Margot, I said no. And if that doesn't work for you, talk to your grandmother. I'm hanging up."
Which he did. He shouted out the open door to his assistant,
"Beverly, no calls unless it's James Giftos or my mother."
Scowling, Rathburn came over to the seating area and took the ergonomic recliner, lowering the back a few degrees. He said,
"My back, sciatica. Sorry about that call. My daughter backed out of the driveway into my mother's car. Everyone's okay. My daughter asked me to open an Uber account for her. Ha!"
Beverly stuck her head in the doorway.
"Mr. Giftos is on the way up, and your mother's online too."
"Excuse me again," the judge said to Yuki and Art. "I'll be right back."
He left the room and closed the door behind him. Yuki walked over to the wall with the quotes from two presidents, a great actor, and a saint. There was also one from Vince Lombardi, the Green Bay Packers' legendary coach. "We would accomplish many more things if we did not think of them as impossible." Yuki rejoined Art, who quipped,
"Seems like the judge is in a pretty good mood. Am I right?"
"I'm feeling lucky," she said.
The door opened and Judge Rathburn came in with James Giftos right behind him. Giftos nodded at Yuki as he and the judge settled in, all the parties facing one another across a coffee table. Rathburn said,
"Everyone know each other? Good."
He reached under the coffee table to the shelf beneath it, pulled out a sparkly stick about 2 feet long, and shook it a couple of times.
"This is my magic wand. I use it to solve those problems that can't get fixed any other way. Don't make me use it. All right?"
He dropped the wand onto the coffee table.
"All right, then," said Judge Rathburn. "Let's get to it."
Chapter 34. The estimable Judge Kevin Rathburn and opposing counsel in the case against Breonna Hill were sitting around the coffee table in the judge's chambers, ready to discuss the critical issue. Rathburn said,
"James, you filed a motion to exclude the video of the alleged rape. Talk about that."
Giftos said,
"The prosecution claims that my client, Ms. Hill, raped Mr. Christopher. The alleged victim recorded this sex act. We contend that this so-called sexual abuse was a game designed by the so-called victim himself. Mr. Christopher's pre-game setup is not in the video, and therefore it does not accurately reflect what happened that night."
"I see," said Rathburn. "Ms. Castellano, you say what?"
Judge, Mr. Christopher is a victim. No so-called about it. Ms. Hill had aimed her gun at his head. He most definitely did not design a game to be raped. As shown in the recording, he protested throughout the sex act, which was clearly not consensual. And that's why Mr. Giftos wants this evidence excluded.
Rathburn leaned back in his recliner and stared at a place above the bookcases on the opposite wall. After a minute, he righted his chair.
I'm going to allow the video. James, you're free to attack its accuracy during the trial.
Yuki exhaled, but Giftos leaned forward and said,
Your Honor, I move for a change of venue.
Yuki had been afraid of this, had worried about it. Change of venue meant that the case would leave San Francisco, and if Mark Christopher still wished to press charges, she would be reading about the trial like every other person in the world. She really wanted to try this case.
Rathburn said, Really, James? And why would I grant that motion? Because the press has been all over this, Your Honor.
Giftos opened his briefcase, took out a folder, and put it down on the coffee table. Then the shark criminal defense attorney fanned out the papers.
I've collected some of the articles and blog posts about Ms. Hill, who has already been painted as the villain,
Giftos said.
The public has her tied to the stake and is ready to light her up. We will not be able to find an unbiased jury.
Rathburn said,
Ms. Castellano?
Yuki said,
Your Honor, if Ms. Hill can't get a fair trial in San Francisco, where can she get a fair trial? As Mr. Giftos knows full well, if the story is out, it's out. The internet isn't restricted to this city, and pretrial noise is just fake news. Ms. Hill is sometimes painted as the villain, and sometimes Mr. Christopher is the baddie. It's even Stephen.
Rathburn looked impatient and somewhat distracted. Would he decide to send the case elsewhere? Or, like most judges, would he want to preside over what was looking to be a high-profile case, with all of the valuable publicity that would accrue to him? He adjusted his chair, placed his feet firmly on the floor, and said,
Okay, here it is. The case stays in this jurisdiction. The two of you, with my help, will pick a jury untainted by gossip and chatter. We're all capable of doing that. Anything else?
There was silence for the next 5 or 6 seconds.
No? Good, said the judge. See you in court.
Yuki, Art, and James Giftos left the judge's office together, and when they reached the stairs, Giftos leaned down to speak into Yuki's ear.
I've only just begun, young lady. I'm going to crush you. Do you hear me?
Yuki stepped away from him and said,
Do your best and your worst, James. Our case is solid. Do you hear me?
Wonderful, he said. Game on.
Chapter 35. At about 9 o'clock on a drizzly Sunday night, Michael walked south along the 4-lane-wide section of Columbus Avenue that cuts through the North Beach neighborhood. The asphalt was slick with rain. The mist haloed headlights and reflected the brilliant neon signage on both sides of the busy roadway. Michael was restless, and his temper was simmering. He had eaten his microwaved lasagna dinner over the kitchen sink. After that, he'd gone to his closet full of work clothes and reached for the newest coat. The coat was hip-length, charcoal gray with a zip-in lining, and had been purchased at one of the many vintage clothing and second-hand thrift shops around town. He opened a drawer, took out the well-used leather gloves, scissors, his knit cap, and his gun. He cut the tags off the coat, put the gun into his right-hand pocket, pulled on the cap and gloves, shut the drawer. He looked at himself in the mirror. He looked completely unremarkable. Leaving the house on Russian Hill, Michael grabbed the still-wet umbrella from the doorstep, crossed the street, and dropped his alimony check into the mailbox on the corner. He could have wired the money, but the check was better. She would have to open it. She would have to read the word bitch he'd put in the memo line. She'd have to cash that check, and the bank teller would see that someone hated her. From his end, writing her name and filling in the blanks by hand forced him to recall the way his marriage had dropped dead, ending against his will. And he thought about what had led to the loss of his wife, and his prospects for a happy life ever after. His life interrupted. As always, all roads led to her. She was to blame for his failed relationships, but he would deal with her sins. He put up his umbrella, patted his gun through the pocket of his coat, and walked toward Columbus Avenue. It was a busy night, the sidewalks and streets spilling over with pedestrian and vehicular traffic. Michael stayed on Greenwich and headed toward downtown. At Mason, he waited for the Powell Mason cable car to pass, rattling its way downhill to the waterfront. Then he took a right onto Columbus toward the heart of North Beach. He pressed on, passing the Condor and then Tosca Cafe on his left and the City Lights bookstore on his right, all the shops and clubs and bars brightly lit. Inside, customers were socializing, enjoying their tiny little plans.
Stupid people. Aliens.
He told himself that he wasn't bothered by their pointless cheerfulness. He thought about the ways he was different from other people as he fixed his eyes on the Transamerica Pyramid up ahead. It was like a beacon, urging him to focus. Humming his own take on a popular tune, Michael veered right onto Kearney at Café Zoetrope. And that's when he saw her. She was only 30 feet up ahead of him, no doubt heading toward the Tenderloin, where the vermin liked to congregate. The woman was bundled up, carrying a heavy shopping bag in each hand, wearing a pink, translucent poncho, her head lowered against the fine, unrelenting rain.
God, he hated her.
And finally, the odds of doing something about that were on his side. Chapter 36. It almost seemed to Michael that he could kill that woman by just drilling through her back with his eyes.
Bam. Bam.
He was keeping her in sight, walking at a comfortable pace. He was starting to wonder where her trek would end, where she'd hunker down for the night, when she picked up her pace and awkwardly trotted across clay just before the light turned red.
Damn it. God damn it.
He was stranded on the sidewalk as traffic swept along between himself and her. The sidewalk across the street was opaque with a moving wall of pedestrians shuffling along beneath their umbrellas. And then he lost sight of her. He was sure that he could catch up with her, if he could still see her. Michael wiped rainwater away from his eyes with his sleeve. He was so close. He might not be this close again any time soon. Kearney was one way, but he looked right and left, his usual overabundance of caution, then dashed off the curb into the street, shooting the gap between two vehicles. He narrowly missed getting clipped by a red sports car, whose driver leaned on the horn, letting him know exactly how close he'd come to buying the farm and everything around it. But the risk had paid off. He was on the opposite curb, unharmed. But where was she? He jogged ahead, cutting between couples, turning right onto Geary, weaving around a boisterous gang of drunkards leaving Hawthorne, a club teeming with customers. And then there was a clearing in the field of umbrellas. Michael peered through the opening and saw her leaning against the 77 Geary building, adjusting the hood of her plastic poncho, setting her bags down at her feet. A memory came to him. College graduation day. She hadn't shown up. When he went to dinner with a few friends, there she was, rooting through the trash outside. He was humiliated. His heartbeat was in overdrive. This was it. He walked toward her, and when he was close enough to read the name Peking Bazaar on one of her shopping bags, he called out to her.
Hey, hey. Imagine meeting you here.
The woman looked up. She gave him a gappy smile and the dizzy look of a person who couldn't quite see straight. She said,
Hi, good looking. Got some change? I haven't eaten today.
His disappointment was fierce and sudden. The loopy female leaning against the wall of the historic office building wasn't her, wasn't even close. Michael cried out.
Oh, shit!
The woman's ditzy look changed to concern. She said,
Are you all right?
Fine,
he snapped. He stood in that glistening clearing of sidewalk that would soon close around him.
I'm just fine,
he said.
I do have something for you.
Holding his umbrella with his left hand, he pulled his gun with his right. He was standing so close to the woman in the many-layered clothing under the shiny plastic wrapper, he could almost count the beads of water on her eyelashes. He fired into her chest. She gasped,
What?
I fucking hate you, he said.
He fired the second round, and as she sagged against the wall, he scooped up the casings and started walking. He didn't look back.
That dirty old lump of dump. No one would even know she was dead until morning.
Michael crossed Geary, his umbrella obscuring his face, but he saw a man running through the rain, coming toward the dead woman with a phone to his ear. He was shouting into the phone, Send an ambulance to Geary and Grant! Hurry! Chapter 37 Michael stood outside the police line do not cross tape, a gray man within a gray crowd under a heavy night sky, the flashing red and blue lights from the squad cars beaming and slashing through the mist. He thought of himself as a cool, professional-grade assassin, but he couldn't quell the heart palpitations and sweat beating up at his hairline, running out from under his cap and mixing with the rain streaming down his face. He rarely had this feeling. This was fear. Extreme fear bordering on panic. He knew that he had screwed up, but he didn't know how badly. Had the woman lived? Could she identify him? What about the man with the phone? After firing on the woman, he'd crossed the street, skirted traffic, passed through alleys, and circumnavigated Union Square. He walked among other pedestrians, returning to the wide avenue, and stopped on the sidewalk to put his hands on his knees and take calming breaths. Then Michael resumed walking. He made a wide loop around the scene of the shooting, taking a route from one end of Post Street to Kearney, then to Market and back up Grant, finally drawn back to Geary Street and what he'd done there. He had a grip on himself now. A crowd of curiosity seekers had assembled across the street from the office building, behind the police tape that held them back from the scene of the shooting. Michael merged into the dull gray crowd, taking a place at the end of a row three people deep. He asked the man in front of him,
What happened over there?
Don't know.
Someone must have died.
Michael hoped. His view of the dead woman was blocked by two squad cars parked up against the curb. He saw cops talking to one another, heard radios squawking, and finally a shrill, whooping siren of an ambulance screaming up the street, breaking hard only yards from where Michael stood. Ambulance doors flew open. Paramedics jumped down from the back with a stretcher and moved quickly toward where Michael had last seen that woman. Did the presence of an ambulance mean that she was still showing signs of life? Even in the crowd and under his umbrella, he felt exposed and transparent. He wanted to slip away. Go home. Go online. Look for news. He should do that. But instead, he stood. More people had joined the crowd, and some of the cops had broken away from their cars to hold back the swelling mob.
Go on home, everyone. This isn't the circus.
Michael looked beyond the cop and saw another car pull up, a gray Chevy sedan. Two people got out. The driver was a tall woman with a blonde ponytail who was wearing a vest marked SFPD over her jacket. The man with her was the same height and was wearing a matching vest. He'd seen cops at the scenes of his other crimes, but he'd never seen these two before. The woman cop seemed to be in charge. She walked past the line of cruisers, and for a split second, a sight line opened up. Michael saw paramedics standing near the body, not lifting it onto a stretcher, not doing anything. Because the lump of dump was dead. Relief flooded through his body, lifting his heart like a lifeboat on a swelling sea. He watched the female cop pull her phone from her pocket. He thought that she was going to take pictures of the body before it was taken away. But no. The cop crossed the street toward the people standing jammed together behind the yellow tape. She turned the phone so that it was facing his end of the crowd, and fanning it from left to right, she snapped off several flash shots with her phone. Michael felt as though she had actually shot him. His lifeboat of a heart deflated and sank. The cop held up her badge and said to the gathering of bystanders, "I'm Sergeant Lindsay Boxer of the SFPD. Did anyone see what happened?" Michael pivoted on his heel and headed away from the crowd, the feeling of exposure making him reel. Damn her to hell! That bitch cop who'd just snapped his picture had caught him off guard and pinned him in perpetuity to the crowd standing 30 feet away from the body. All women were trouble, and this one, especially this one, looked like she had mastered the art of female bitchery. When she snapped those pictures, he took the mental image of her. Sergeant Lindsay Boxer. He would remember that. Part 2. Chapter 38. In Cindy Thomas's view, the gossip, rumors, and overheated crosstalk about the alleged rape of Mark Christopher had electrified and divided the people of San Francisco before the trial had even begun. But in just over an hour, the curtain would go up on the People v. Hill, and actual testimony and evidence would deny or feed the internet's speculation. With luck, Cindy thought, she would score one of the few available press seats in Judge Rathburn's courtroom. Cindy parked her car in the all-day lot on Bryant, grabbed her computer bag, and as she got out of her car, was smacked with a gust of chilly morning breeze. She buttoned her coat, got her ticket from the attendant, and hurried toward the corner where she waited for the light to change. As traffic sped past her, Cindy took note of the media satellite vans jammed tightly at the curb and the press setups on the sidewalk in front of the Hall of Justice. The excessive media coverage of a local event underscored what she'd been feeling for weeks. A cultural belief was being challenged, and this story was going surprisingly large and wide. The case against Breonna Hill wasn't Cindy's first media storm, but it was the first that didn't involve a kidnapping or loss of life. The rape of a full-grown and athletic man in his late 20s by an attractive young advertising executive weighing in at about 110 pounds had neatly split the followers on her crime blog. Half of the commenters fiercely maintained that a man couldn't be raped by a woman. The other half insisted that yes, a man could be raped by a woman, and the determining factor was consent. Consent was legally correct. But could Yuki prove her case? The light changed, and as Cindy crossed the four-lane street and approached the wide front staircase, she tugged on the chain around her neck, freeing her press pass so that security could see it. She worked her way through the gathering of people at the base of the Hall of Justice steps. She guessed that most of them were hoping to glimpse one of the major players in the trial. Mark Christopher, Breonna Hill, either of the attorneys who would be trying the case, or Judge Rathburn, who was known to make colorful, off-the-cuff remarks. The courtroom itself held only 50 people in the gallery, and as the senior crime reporter for the Chronicle, Cindy generally got a seat. Today, with the trial attracting so much media attention, those precious seats would go fast on a first-come, first-served basis. Breathless, Cindy joined the line, which went from the steps into the courthouse and slowly climbed toward the security station just inside the doors. When she got to the walk-through metal detector, she placed her computer bag on the table, showed the guard her pass. He ran the wand alongside her body, and when her bag appeared at the end of the conveyor belt, she slung it over her shoulder and sprinted to catch an elevator. It was only 8:15. Court wouldn't convene until 9. She would be standing outside the courtroom door when it opened. Right now, getting a seat in Judge Rathburn's courtroom was the most important appointment of her day. Chapter 39. Courtroom 23 was a no-frills wood-paneled room with two flags flanking the California state seal on the wall behind the bench, two counsel tables facing it, and 8 rows of upholstered metal frame seats behind the bar that were divided by the center aisle. At 8:45, Yuki and Arthur Barron were at the prosecution's counsel table, and Yuki was nerved up. She felt like an athlete coming into the stadium before the big game against the current champions. Or like a base jumper pushing off the cliff into the wide open air, wearing only a wingsuit. Would the wingsuit support her flight? Or would a stiff breeze dash her into the rocks? As the hands on the clock over the side door notched ever closer to 9 a.m., Yuki thought about her preparation for this trial. Since Brianna Hill's arraignment, she and Arthur had dug into relevant case histories of rape trials in California. They had prepped their witnesses, and they had fine-tuned their arguments. Yuki had rehearsed her opening statement with Arthur until she could hit every beat without consulting her notes, but not sound mechanical when it really counted. Last week had been devoted to voir dire. Judge Rathburn had made good on his promise to help counsel select unbiased jurors, and up to a point, both attorneys were satisfied. As always in picking jurors, attorneys were making calculated guesses, but could often be surprised by the decisions the jurors made. No one knew what a jury was going to do, as Yuki had first learned by watching the film of the O.J. Simpson trial when she was in law school. She would never forget the stunned look on criminal defense attorney Robert Kardashian's face when his client was found not guilty. His team had won. Their client had been found not guilty. But Kardashian was blindsided. This morning, Yuki had been awake before Brady. She had dressed in her fighting red suit and awoken her husband for a good luck kiss.
"Today's the day," she said.
"I wish I could be there," he said. "You look hot."
Yuki hadn't really expected Brady to show up for her first day of trial, but she would have loved it if he had. She hid the pang of disappointment, kissed him, and minutes later drove to the Hall of Justice. Art had been waiting for her inside courtroom 23. As Yuki settled into her seat at the prosecution table, she shot a quick look across the aisle. Giftos was at the defense table with Madison Benson, his second chair. He was speaking softly to Brianna Hill, no doubt assuring her that everything would go well. Until her world had come crashing down, Hill had been on the success track in advertising. She was dressed today as though she weren't out on bail and unemployed, but rather still on the executive payroll at the ad shop. Her patterned gray and white skirt suit was smart, and her wavy chestnut hair hung to her shoulders, adding to her already very young, even innocent, appearance. Behind the bar, at Yuki's back, the gallery filled with spectators, who conversed and laughed as they found their seats. Unlike with murder trials, there was no sense of solemnity or tragedy. Instead, Yuki picked up the daytime talk show giddiness in the air. The audience was titillated, as if they were hoping there would be goodie bags under the seats. When she last scanned the gallery, Yuki had picked out Mark Christopher's parents, Lily and Fred Christopher, sitting 2 rows back from the rail. Yuki had also spotted Cindy in the last row, with Lindsay right beside her. Yuki felt a rush of gratitude toward her friends for being here. Just then, Arthur nudged her with his elbow, and Yuki turned around as the bailiff took a stance in front of the bench and intoned,
"All rise."
The spectators, the attorneys, the victim, and the defendant all got to their feet as Judge Rathburn came through the door behind the bench and took his chair. The bailiff called court into session. Chapter 40. Yuki watched the judge swivel in his chair, getting comfortable. He poked at his laptop, spoke a few words to his clerk, then greeted the jury. After saying how important jury duty was to the justice system and thanking the jurors for their service, the judge began to explain the case that would be presented to them.
In California, the rape statute broadly defines rape as non-consensual sexual intercourse accomplished by means of threats, force, or fraud. It's common to think of rape as a sex act committed by means of physical force. But other situations can also lead to rape charges in our state. A woman is passed out drunk. A man has sex with her. That's rape. A doctor or a psychologist tells a patient that having sex with him or her will cure an illness. That's rape.
Rathburn went on to explain clearly and forcefully to a rapt audience that if a cop pulled over a motorist and told the driver there would be no ticket if said motorist agreed to have sex with him, that was rape too.
Now, it is commonly believed that only men can commit rape. That's not true, said Rathburn. The defendant in this case is a woman, and she is charged with forcing a man to penetrate her without his consent.
Rathburn cleared his throat before telling the jury that he had a duty to instruct them on the elements defining penetration, which he would read to them from the California Penal Code. The judge pulled his laptop close and read,
"Sexual penetration, however slight, of the genital or anal opening of the other person, or causing the other person to penetrate the other party's genital or anal opening."
The language of the statute was more than one man in the gallery could handle. He laughed sharply, igniting titters from the back of the room. Even one of the jurors grinned before clapping her hands over her mouth. Rathburn's face darkened. He slammed down his gavel, the cracks sounding like gunfire and having a similar effect.
"Enough!" Rathburn barked. "Will the court officers show the man in the red tie to the door?"
The man with the red tie and matching complexion sputtered an apology, but Rathburn ignored him. When the disruptor had been marched out and the doors had been closed, the judge addressed the spectators.
"Anyone who cannot sit quietly in this courtroom, who cannot control their emotions, please leave now. Likewise, any members of the jury who are having second thoughts about serving in a case about rape, let me know now."
Rathburn waited. The spectators were mute and motionless. The jurors as a body seemed to have stopped breathing. There was no question in Yuki's mind that His Honor, Kevin Rathburn, had laid down the law in his court. Chapter 41. Judge Rathburn waited out the dense silence, cleared his throat, and after putting down his gavel, directed his attention back to the jurors and alternates in the jury box. He said,
"Here's the crux of the matter. In order to prove that the defendant is guilty of rape, the people must show that Ms. Hill caused Mark Christopher to sexually penetrate her, however slightly, and that Mr. Christopher did not consent to this sexual act. Specifically, the people must show that Ms. Hill accomplished this sexual act by force or violence, duress, or menace."
Yuki exhaled as Rathburn resumed his explanation of the charges and the responsibilities of the jury. This time, no one in courtroom 23 sniggered or even twitched.
"I'm going to define some terms," Rathburn said.
The judge listed and defined the terms.
"If the victim was reasonably afraid that he would be harmed, his consent was not freely given. Furthermore," he said, "if Ms. Hill and Mr. Christopher were intimate previously, that in and of itself does not constitute consent. So what exactly is consent? Consent means that the person acted freely and voluntarily and understood the nature of the act. The people must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Hill did not reasonably believe that Mr. Christopher had consented to this sexual act. If the people have not met this burden, the jury must find the defendant not guilty."
Yuki shot a look at James Giftos. In a word, he looked pleased. Rathburn told the spectators again about proper decorum, and then swiveled his seat so that he was directly facing Yuki. He leaned back in his chair. Springs squeaked, and when he said,
"Ms. Castellano, are the people ready to make their opening statement?"
Yuki felt an adrenaline rush, and she liked it.
"Yes, Your Honor," she said. "The people are ready."
Chapter 42. Yuki pushed back her chair and walked around the counsel table to the podium that stood at the midpoint of the well, facing the jury box. She adjusted the mic attached to the stand, greeted the jurors, and introduced herself and her second chair, Arthur. Feeling the wind beneath her wingsuit, Yuki took a breath and launched the prosecution's version of the events that had brought the defendant to trial.
"The defendant, Brianna Hill, committed rape," Yuki said. "She may not look like a rapist, a criminal, but that is exactly what she is. The defendant and Mark Christopher both worked at an advertising agency called The Ad Shop. Ms. Hill was head of the TV production department, and Mr. Christopher reported to her. They started dating, going out to dinner once a week for a couple of months, and often spending the night together."
Yuki continued.
"On the night of October 11th, the defendant and Mr. Christopher had dinner at a restaurant called Panacea, and afterward, they hung out in the bar, talking and drinking. According to the bar tab, which has been pre-admitted into evidence, the defendant had 3 shots of Jameson, and Mr. Christopher drank 5 beers. Mr. Christopher will tell you that at about midnight they went back to his apartment where, if things had progressed according to their habit, they would have had sex and fallen asleep. In the morning, the defendant would have gone home to change her clothes, and separately they would have gone to work. Now here's the critical piece of this incident. The defendant customarily carried a registered Smith & Wesson 38 caliber revolver in her purse for protection. You will see and hear evidence, Yuki said, that the defendant had that gun in her possession on the night in question.
At this point in the trial, the jurors were uncommitted to the outcome because they had not heard the story. Yuki had to engage them, inform them, and leave them with an indelible vision of how Mark Christopher had been victimized by the defendant. Putting a gun on Brianna Hill's person had set the hook. From here on, Yuki would lay out the scene so that the jurors would not just hear, but visualize, even feel, what the defendant had done to the victim. How Brianna Hill had derailed the trajectory of his life. Chapter 43. Yuki Castellano was 5'2" in heels, but she commanded the room in her fire engine red suit as she left the podium and took a position 10 feet away from the jurors. Then she began to lead them directly into the heart of her case. Yuki said,
"On October 11th, after their evening out, Mark Christopher opens his apartment door and the defendant follows him inside. He strips off his clothing in the living room, and after using the bathroom, feeling the effects of dinner and much beer, he goes into the bedroom and falls face down on his bed. He wakes up because the defendant is sharply calling his name. He turns over and sees the defendant is holding a gun pointed right at his face and saying that she wants to have sex. At that moment, Mr. Christopher thinks she's just kidding around. He tells the defendant that he is wasted, can't, doesn't want to, needs to sleep. So what does the defendant do? She opens Mr. Christopher's closet and brings out a handful of his neckties. She demands that he tie his feet to the footboard or she will shoot him."
Yuki continued, walking slowly in front of the jury box, taking the time to look at each of the jurors. She went on.
"Mr. Christopher says, 'You're being ridiculous, Brianna. Come to bed.' But that's not what happens. The defendant taunts Mr. Christopher, tells him that she is going to do whatever she wants with him. Again, Mr. Christopher asks her to knock it off. He says, 'Brianna, stop.' But she doesn't stop. She waves her gun in his direction and again orders him to tie his ankles to the footboard. Mr. Christopher knows that the defendant is drunk and maybe she's crazy, too. He figures that the gun is loaded and might even go off by accident. The defendant is not slurring her words, but she is acting totally unhinged. And now Mr. Christopher has gone from stupefied to irritated to terrified. This crazy woman may actually fire the gun. That, ladies and gentlemen, goes directly to the victim's state of mind. Mr. Christopher will tell you that he tries to convince himself not to panic. Rather, he tries to mollify her. He says, 'Jesus, Brianna, what's gotten into you? Are you okay? You're freaking me out. Please put the gun down.' That's when the defendant screams at him, 'Do what I tell you, you little bitch.'"
Yuki paused and saw that the jurors looked stunned. Then she went on.
Mr. Christopher gets it. The defendant is not joking. He is shaking, and as he ties up his ankles, the defendant makes her next demand. She tells him to tie up his left wrist to the headboard. Thinking he may be in his last moments on Earth, Mr. Christopher reaches over to his nightstand,
Yuki acted it out,
and surreptitiously presses the record button on his clock, which is in fact a disguised spy cam. He will tell you that he's thinking if the defendant murders him, at least the police will be able to find who killed him. And the terror does not stop. Now that Mr. Christopher's left hand is tied to the headboard, the defendant secures his right hand, leaving Mr. Christopher lying naked, spread-eagle, face up on the bed. He's staring down the barrel of a gun. I urge you to imagine how that must have felt.
Chapter 44. Yuki had not taken her eyes off the jury since she began her opening statement, and she didn't do it now. Nor had the jurors taken their eyes away from her. She wanted to keep it that way. She said,
At this point, the defendant puts down the gun and undresses. Then, naked, she advances on Mr. Christopher, who is trussed to the bed and utterly helpless. The defendant takes her victim's genitals into her hands and mouth and manipulates him until he is erect. But she's not done. Not yet. Even though Mr. Christopher begs her to stop before she does something she will regret, the defendant mounts him and succeeds in having him penetrate her. She has sexual intercourse with him without his consent.
Yuki paused to let her narrative sink in. Then she asked rhetorically,
So what happens after that? Just before the video recorder runs out of space, we see that both parties are asleep. Mr. Christopher will tell you that in the morning, when he wakes up, the defendant is gone and his wrists are untied. He releases his ankles, and although still shaken to his core, he goes to work, where both parties avoid each other. Like the legendary plague.
Yuki said,
What is the defendant thinking? We will probably never know, but the victim will wonder for the rest of his life. For his part, Mr. Christopher will testify that he feels mortified and he's worried. What if the defendant is now pregnant? Is he responsible? What will happen to him at his job? Who is he now that he has been violated by a woman that he cared about, when it is clear to him by her actions that she didn't care for him at all? Days go by, and Mr. Christopher is having nightmares and is in a crushing depression. He neglects his job. He stops socializing with friends. It takes a couple of weeks for him to fully understand and get angry about what was done to him. He understands now that he has been raped,
Yuki told the jurors.
Sexually assaulted, and he is ashamed. He blames himself for not knowing the woman he was dating at all. And as rape victims often experience, the pain doesn't fade in the passing days. In fact, it gets worse. 2 weeks after the assault, Mr. Christopher goes to the police. Over the next few days, Brianna Hill is interviewed, arrested, and charged with rape.
Yuki let the word rape resonate in the silent courtroom. Then she told the jury about the witnesses who would testify for the prosecution. The police officer, the video technician, the psychologist specializing in human sexuality, and Paul Yates, another man who had gone out with the defendant. And then she began to wind her opening statement to a close.
We will also introduce to you the unedited recording that Mr. Christopher made of this assault, and you will see for yourself what happened to him on the night of October 11th. Now some might say, so she made him have sex at gunpoint. Big deal. They'd had sex before. But it is a big deal. Mark Christopher said no. As Judge Rathburn told you,
Yuki said,
forcing someone, menacing that person, causing that person to be reasonably afraid that he would be harmed, to have sex with someone without his consent, is a felony. You will see that Mr. Christopher did not consent and that Ms. Hill clearly knew that he did not. She took what she wanted for her own gratification, without any regard for Mr. Christopher at all. After our witnesses have testified, and you have seen the evidence, the people will ask you to find the defendant, Brianna Hill, guilty of rape, and punish her for that crime.